Best-selling writer Thomas Cahill is writing a series of books on what he calls the hinges of history. They're about ancient cultures that shaped our modern world. His latest is called Sailing the Wine-Dark Sea, Why the Greeks Matter. What's remarkable about the ancient Greeks is the way they revolutionized so many different aspects of life. Art, science, philosophy, and politics. Steve Paulson sat down with Cahill to talk about the glory of ancient Greece.
How do you explain this incredible cultural flowering in this particular place at this time?
Well, very early in the book, I quote the eminent Dr. Seuss and say that it just happened to happen. But it still is true that the geography of Greece certainly was a factor. Greece is so cut up geographically. You know, there's a peninsula here, a peninsula there, islands all over the place. And I think that this meant that there were many, many small communities within Greece.
And I suppose they're always interacting with each other.
Well, that's the other thing.
Sailing from one island to the next.
Yes, the sailing, of course, was a big part of it. And they spoke one language. They all spoke Greek. They knew they were Greeks. And at the same time, the localities and the differences from one locality to another contributed greatly to the variety of Greek culture. For instance, Corinth was a real crossroads between Europe and Asia. It was a place of enormous variety of goods coming in from different places, all sorts of exotica. And Corinth, because of its position, became extremely rich and was known as Fat Corinth to the Greeks themselves. It was a place of absolute and utter sybaritic pleasure. That's what they did in Corinth. Sparta was extremely Spartan. No one had any pleasure in Sparta as far as I can see.
But they seemed to be very good at conducting wars there.
Yeah, they became better and better, but it was landlocked. It didn't have any. It was completely unlike Corinth in that it had no access to anything. And it was the most wretched kind of military dictatorship. I compare it to North Korea. Then you have Athens, the home of democracy and art and free speech, a kind of air of freedom that went through the place, and the home of drama, both of tragedy and comedy. These are very, very different places from one another.
So how do you, Athens, I mean, how do you explain all of the stuff that happened in this particular city?
Well, they got a great kick out of being different from one another. It's certainly true that long before the rise of democracy in Athens, you see it in the Iliad, which is the beginning of Greek literature. On the night before the battle, all the soldiers have arguments about how the battle should be conducted on the next day. Everybody has an opinion. Everybody throws his 2 cents in, and nobody gets hanged from the nearest tree for disagreeing with the general.
And I suppose that must have been a radical development in that day and age.
It stands alone because it's the only society in which the king doesn't have the first and the last word. Everybody else seems to jump in.
You mentioned the Iliad, the first great book certainly in Greek culture, maybe in Western culture. In a lot of ways, the Iliad shows a totally different world than we live in today. I mean, there's all of this talk about honor and glory.
Mm-hmm.
Values that I have a hard time relating to.
No, that's quite true. And I mean, there are two great streams of the Western tradition, the Judeo-Christian and the Greco-Roman. The Judeo-Christian stream gives us our value system, and honor and glory are not at the center of that system. You know, things like justice and charity are, which are very different and which were not at the center of the Greek system. No two ways about it.
Well, I have to tell you that the Iliad was a story that I always loved as a kid, I mean, in some pared-down version. And I always identified with the Trojans. Hector was the guy I liked, the great tragic hero of the Trojans. And, of course, he's killed by Achilles. And Achilles, to me, was this rather unappealing figure. And I don't know if I'm unusual here or if we're meant to identify with the Trojans, with the losers of the war.
Well, first of all, the Iliad is a real boy's story. it's a perfect story for pre-adolescent boys, I think. And in many ways, the Greeks of that period, you could compare them to pre-adolescent boys. That's what they were like, you know? They had lots of fantasies about winning on battlefields, probably a lot more fantasies than actualities. And I also think it's true that for Homer, the secret heroes of the Iliad are not the Greeks, but the Trojans. I agree. And in fact, Iliad is a story about Ilium, which was the ancient name of Troy. So it's not a story about the Greeks. It's a story about Troy. There was an actual Troy, but the Troy that Homer presents is a place that never existed. It's a Shangri-La. It's a place of perfection and peace and wonderful, noble figures like Priam. Priam, the king of the Trojans, is a much more noble and attractive figure than Agamemnon, the king of the Greeks, who's really kind of an extremely annoying guy who's so full of himself that mm-hmm. he can't see what's going on.
And then you get Hector, who is not only a great warrior, but also he's a good family man. I mean, he dotes on his child and his wife, and he's just sort of a good guy all around, and he also knows he's going to die.
The portrayal of Hector and his family is the first time in ancient literature anywhere where a family is shown as a loving unit. Never before that. So I think there are things going on, even in the Iliad, sort of hints in Homer that he doesn't really think that warfare is quite as splendid as everyone else thinks it is. But they're only hints. Then in the later epic, the Odyssey, which I believe Homer wrote when he was old and much more reflective, all those hints in the Iliad come to the fore. And the second epic is really not a hymn to war. It's a hymn to peace.
Well, and it's a much more modern book from our own perspective. I mean, Odysseus he's kind of the anti-hero. I mean, I suppose he's a reasonably skilled fighter, but, you know, he's cunning more than anything
else. That's right. He's the guy who lives by his wits.
Yeah, he's a trickster.
Yeah, and that's what he's really good at. He is not so much a warrior as an extremely canny human being who figures out how to outwit enemies, not by superior strength, but by superior brains.
And then the other thing about Odysseus is that it takes him 10 years from the end of the Trojan War to get home. He's always trying to get home. But you get the sense that he's kind of enjoying himself while he's getting home. And there are lots of beautiful women and adventures and all kinds of
this is Greece.
Interesting things.
And again, this is not the Judeo-Christian epic. This is a Greek epic. And there's no two ways about it that he does enjoy himself along the way. And as far as a Greek would be concerned, there's no reason why he shouldn't. What else would he do?
Now, we've been talking about how so much of our own culture today comes from ancient Greece. There was a dark side to this. I mean, to Athens, this jewel of culture back then, much of the population of Athens was made up of slaves. Women had no political rights at all.
Yeah, if I had been an ancient Greek, I would definitely want to have been one of those free Athenians. You know, to be a woman would really not have been a lot of fun, and certainly not to be a slave. And surely the better part of Athenian society was made up of non-citizens. So when you look back in that way, you know, you see a rather dreary place. But it's still true that these are the first people to think of any form of democracy. And their form of democracy was like California gone mad. Everybody voted on everything all the time. They had a direct democracy. There were no representatives. The assembly of the Greeks was everybody, you know. They all barged into this place on a hill outside Athens, and they all got to vote on it. They even voted on who their generals would be. They communally decided who should be expelled from their city because the person might be gaining too much power and was therefore a threat to the democracy.
How many people would be voting on these matters?
Well, we know that Athens at its height was probably not more than about 250,000 people, and that would have been everybody. And it would have been between 10 and 15% at the outside, 20% who were able to vote.
But that's extraordinary to think that many people still would be voting on these rather important matters.
I don't think they ever got more than 50% of the eligible citizens into the assembly at any one time. There was another forum that actually got more people, which was the drama, which was an Athenian invention. And it was a political invention, which people don't always realize. It was another way of talking about their politics besides the assembly.
And you have some extraordinary plays. I mean, for instance, the Aristophanes play Lysistrata. I mean, we were talking earlier about war and how warlike the Greeks were in many respects. I mean, this is a play about how the women refuse to have sex with their men as long as they're fighting.
Yeah, it's still hilarious, I think. The stage business is wonderful. I'm not even sure you can say some of it over the air, but...
I mean, the thing is, it still is kind of radical today.
Yeah, yeah. Well, whereas the tragedians set their stories in among the myths of the Greeks and showed in a pointed way how they had something to do with the present, the comic playwrights talked directly about the present and even put on stage the leading figures of Athens and ridiculed them to death. I mean, they made such fun of those people. There are still many places on our contemporary earth where if you did something like that, you'd be tortured or executed. The Athenians loved it. I mean, they took it all in. It was terrific as far as they were concerned. Well, you know, there's a direct relationship between that and Saturday Night Live. I mean, you couldn't have the kind of political comedy that we have if somebody hadn't started it somewhere along the line, and they were the guys who started it.
Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
Thomas Cahill, talking with Steve Paulson. Cahill's book is called Sailing the Wine-Dark Sea, Why the Greeks Matter.